When two enemies are talking, they're not fighting. A black man and the Ku Klux Klan have worked together. Stay tuned as we find out the details on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes, those are my babies. As always, thanks for getting Daddy started today. Mwah. Author and musician Daryl Davis is with us, and I'm curious, why did you, a black man, want to interview members of the KKK?
Because I kept running into them. I wanted to find out what makes them tick. How can you hate me when you don't even know me? So that was the impetus for my interviewing them.
And how'd you manage to run into them consistently?
Well, knowingly,
I guess, run into them. Not
no. Initially, I had no idea.
Okay.
My first time was I'll talk about my second time. My second time was I was playing in a country band up in Frederick, Maryland, at a place called the Silver Dollar Lounge, which is at the Frederick truck stop, which is at the intersection of 270 and 70. Mm-hmm. Today it's a Costco. Back in the 80s and early 90s, it was a truck stop. And the lounge there, truck stop lounge, called the Silver Dollar, was an all-white lounge. When I say all-white, I don't mean that blacks could not go in there. What I mean is that blacks did not go in there by their own choice, which was a good choice because they were not welcome.
And this was around what period of time?
This is 1983.
Okay. And Frederick is just 30 miles away from D.C.
Right.
30
right.
minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but you can find racism 30 feet from D.C.,
absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. Not even from.
Yeah. In.
So, anyway, the band had played there before, the country band that I had joined, because country music had made a resurgence in the 80s with a movie called Urban Cowboy. All the bars went country. And so I was the only black guy in this band. And my first time in the place. And when I came off the bandstand after the first set, I was walking to the table to sit with my bandmates, and this a white gentleman, probably in his mid-40s, came up and put his arm around my shoulder and talked about, you know, I really enjoyed your all's music. I said, thank you, and I shook his hand. And he says, you know, I've seen this here band before, but I had never seen you before. Where'd you come from? And I said, I just joined the band a couple months ago. It's my first time in here, but, you know, they've played here before. He goes, yeah, I've seen them before. He goes, you know, this is the first time I ever saw a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. And I wasn't offended. I was just kind of surprised, you know, that he didn't know the origin of Jerry Lee's music. And I wasn't trying to be facetious. I said, well, where do you think Jerry Lee Lewis learned how to play? And he says, what are you talking about? And I explained to him that Jerry Lee learned that style from the same place I did, from black blues and boogie-woogie piano players. That's where that rock and roll, rockabilly-type piano came from. And he was incredulous, said, no, you know, Jerry Lee invented that. You know, I never heard no black man play piano like that before except for you. So I'm thinking, okay, well, this guy's never seen Little Richard or Fats Domino. And, you know, we argued back and forth. I explained to the guy that I know Jerry Lee Lewis. He's a good friend of mine. I've known him since I was 13 years old.
Whoa.
He's told me himself where he learned how to play. The guy didn't believe me. And but he wanted to buy me a drink because he was fascinated with me. And I went back to his table, and he bought me a cranberry juice, which I asked for. And then he took his glass, and he clinked my glass and cheered me and said, you know, this is the first time I ever sat down and had a drink with a black man. And now I'm like, you know, wondering, what on earth is going on here? I mean, I'm 25 years old, 1983, and I have sat down with thousands of white people or anybody else, had a meal, a conversation, a beverage. This guy was in his mid-40s and never sat down with a black guy before. And I know that there are black people in Frederick because I've seen them. So how did he miss them? And innocently, I asked him, I said, why? And he didn't answer me at first. And I asked him again. He had a friend sitting next to him who elbowed him in the ribs. I said, tell him, tell him. And I said, tell me. And he said, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And I started laughing because I didn't believe him.
Wow.
So he produced his Klan membership card, gave it to me. I looked at it, and I recognized the Klan insignia, which is called a Mayoke, a blood drop emblem. It's a red circle with a white cross and a blood drop in the center. And I stopped laughing.
Card-carrying KKK member.
But he gave me his phone number and wanted me to call him anytime I was to return to this bar with this band, because he wanted to bring his friends, meaning Klansmen and Klanswomen, to see this black guy play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. So I would call him every 6 weeks, and he would come, you know, whenever we came back to that bar, and he'd bring some Klan members there. Some of them wanted to meet me when I came off on break. Others, when I came towards the table, they would, like, scurry away. You know, they wanted nothing to do with me, just, like, kind of watch me from afar. But he and I became friends, and that was the first foray into it. The first time I met a Klansman, it was violent.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you opened it. Let's hear it.
Well, I was playing at a bar, and there was a restaurant across the parking lot.
Where was this bar?
Again, in Frederick, Maryland.
Okay. No joke.
Yeah. Okay. And I was by myself. I pulled into the restaurant parking lot, and there was a guy straddled across a woman on the sidewalk, and he was beating her head into the sidewalk and smacking her in the face. And I pulled maybe 20 feet away was my parking space. He was totally oblivious to the fact that I'm parking. He just kept on hitting her. And when I got out of the car, because I was going to go over there, when I got out of the car, when I closed my door, that, like, you know, made him aware somebody was there. He, like, looked up, and I'm looking right at him. And he asked me, "What the F are you looking at, N-word?" And I told him I was looking at him, and I called him a name. And he got up and came at me, and I had to put him down. But people were standing around watching. Nobody went to help this woman. And they didn't call the police until I had put him down on the ground. Okay? So when the police came...
This was what year?
This was 1982. When the police came, something was very odd, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And they told him to leave the property, and if he set foot back there within 24 hours, he would be arrested for trespassing. I wanted him arrested.
Right. They didn't arrest
him? He didn't hurt me. I hurt him. Right. But just the fact, you know, there were no hate crime laws back then, so using that kind of language, you know, was neither here nor there back at that time. But I wanted him arrested for assault, and they wouldn't do
of
it.
Of you
or
of her?
The woman,
of
right?
Me. Of, okay. Well, of me. I mean, I can't press charges for assault for her. She had to do that herself.
No, but I'm saying they didn't even arrest him for what he had done to the
exactly,
woman.
Exactly. Okay, so they wouldn't arrest him. And so I knew I would have to go to the police station, to the commissioner's office, and fill out a warrant, summons for him, and file a complaint. So I went inside. I got some ice for the lady. I put her on her head and all that kind of stuff. And she gave me her phone number. And I told her, you know, I'd like her to be a witness. And I said I would testify on her behalf as well. And she agreed, gave me her phone number. So then I left. You know, she was okay. And I went down to the police station. And I'm telling the commissioner what happened. I'm filling out the complaint, right? And I said to the commissioner, I said, you know, how long before this thing is served? And he said, well, I'll sign it, and then I'll send it down to the sheriff's department. When, you know, one of the deputies will, because the police had to give me the guy's information so I could put his name and address or all that kind of stuff on the complaint. So he says, I'll give it to the deputies, and they'll serve it probably about 3 days. I said, okay. Right about then, in walks the guy. In walks the guy that I beat up. Okay? He's with two other police officers. The police officers who came to investigate initially were Frederick County police officers. All right? When he came into the station, he was in handcuffs with two Maryland State troopers. All right? So I looked up and I saw him coming in handcuffs. And I said, there he is, there he is. That's the guy right there. And so the commissioner says, finish it up, sign it, and I'll serve him right now. I said, okay. So I finished it up. He rolled it up. He walked outside, and the guy had his hands cuffed behind his back. He stuck it in between his arm and his side. And so he was served. Now, what happened apparently was this. The initial cops told him to leave the property, and if he were to come back within 24 hours, he'd be arrested, right? Mm-hmm. So he left. Mm-hmm. When the cops left, he came back to settle the score with me.
Uh-huh.
All right? And I wasn't there, and he got into a fight with another black guy in the restaurant.
Ooh. Oh.
So now Maryland State Police came, mm-hmm. and he was arrested. So
the woman, she was white.
She was white, yes. Mm-hmm. And long story short, that was his ex-fiance. Mm-hmm. And I went and picked her up and brought her to court the day of the trial. Mm-hmm. And on the way to court, she told me that he was a Klansman. Mm-hmm. And what had happened was he was in the Frederick County Fire Department. Mm-hmm. Okay? And he was high up in the department. Mm-hmm.
Which was
explained
why the police,
it. Because why the police did not arrest him.
They
all knew each other.
Him.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So that's your buddy or whatever, or, you know, one of their colleagues kind of thing. Yeah. So professional courtesy kind of thing.
Right.
He did not get arrested. And but anyway, he was found guilty, and he had to pay damages and all kinds of stuff
to
serve a weekend.
Pay damages to who?
Well, he had to pay me for a coat that I was wearing where he had torn it.
Uh-huh. Whoa.
And then he had a fine for disturbing the peace and assault. And it was the his attorney. What was interesting was this: the trial was like in July. The incident happened in March, all right? Mm-hmm. So the day before the hearing, his attorney called me up on the phone. And he says, "Mr. Davis," I said, "Yes." And he said, "This is so-and-so. I'm representing so-and-so. You had an altercation with him." I said, "Oh, yes." He says, "Well, listen, we have the money for your coat. You know, I understand there was some damage to a leather coat that you were wearing." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yes." He goes, "Well, we have the money, and Mr. So-and-so is very sorry about the altercation. You know, if you'd like to come to my office, or I could fax you a waiver, you know, you sign the waiver, you know, dropping the charges, and I'll send you the check." And I said, "No."
Mm.
And he said, "Well, why not? You're coming to court to sue him for damages to your property. And he's willing to pay it. I have the check right here." I said, "No." I said, I want to go to court." He goes, "Well, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to waste your time? You have to take a day off of work, blah, blah, blah." Well, he didn't know I didn't work, right? I'm a musician.
He's a musician,
I work,
right.
But it's at nighttime,
right,
you know?
Right.
So it didn't matter to me. I could sit in court all day long. So I insisted. And he got very disconcerted about that and hung up on me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to court. Oh, I asked him. He said, "Well, you know, his client was very sorry what had happened." And I said, "Well, how did you get my phone number?" And he said, it's on the complaint, which it was. Mm-hmm. And I said, "So your client," and I named him, I said, "your client had my phone number." He says, "Well, in a manner of speaking, yes, because he retained me and he gave me the complaint." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, you know, this incident happened back in March. If your client was so sorry,
why didn't he call me
the next day?" Mm-hmm. You know, you wait until July, the day before the trial, to tell me how sorry he is. No, I want to go to court.
Right.
So that's when he hung up on me. So when I got to the courthouse with the lady, you sit in the courtroom, and the state's attorney comes out, and he reads the docket to make sure everybody's there. So-and-so versus so-and-so. So-and-so versus state of Maryland versus so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people would say present here, whatever. And when he said Daryl Davis versus so-and-so, whatever, I said, present. He looked at me. He said, "Mr. Davis, have a seat over here." And he pointed me in another direction. So I went and sat on that bench. I was the only one sitting there. I was the only one who was called out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kept on down the docket. And when he finished, he said, "Come with me." And so I followed him into his state's attorney's office. And he said, and he pulls out a piece of paper. He goes, "Here you go. We can take care of this right now." I said, "Taking care of what?"
Who said this?
The state's attorney.
The state's attorney.
Yeah, Frederick County state's attorney.
Wow.
Okay. And I said, "What are we taking care of?" He goes, "Well, I understand that you and Mr. meaning the lawyer, settled this."
Settled, right.
And I said, "No." He goes, "Well, I spoke with him." I said, "Well, so did I." And I said, "I want my day in court." And he says, "Well, I understand he's here with the check. you know, if you just want to sign this a waiver, this release, you know, you can be on your way. Mm-hmm. I said, no, I'm not doing it. I want to be in that courtroom. And he says, well, have a seat here for a second. I'll be right back. So he leaves me in his office. He returns with the attorney.
Mm.
All right? And now they both are, like, ganging up on me,
right?
Mm. Trying to understand why, you know, I won't take the check, mm-hmm. because that's what I'm there for. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm here on principle.
Right.
Okay? And I refused it. So they had to take me into the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And when I came in there with the guy's fiance, ex-fiance, what it was. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a complicated story. He was seeing somebody else. The victim, the Klansman. Okay.
The victim.
He was a victim to me.
Right.
He was seeing somebody else. Mm-hmm. And his new fiance did not know anything about the ex-fiance. He still wanted to see the ex-fiance. Mm-hmm. She wanted nothing to do with him. And so he was beating her up. Like, if I can't have you, nobody will, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. All right? And so she knew nothing about it. When he got up there to testify, his attorney explained that this guy had just been promoted to lieutenant in the Frederick County Fire Department. Mm-hmm. There'd been a celebration. He'd been drinking a little bit and partying, and he got a little out of hand. Mm-hmm. The attorney did not say that he said anything racist. All he said was he got into an altercation with Mr. Davis. And he admitted to being guilty and said that, you know, we have the money for Mr. Davis's coat. We're willing to pay that. So he said nothing about the woman, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what happened? Mm-hmm. And his new fiance was like looking at me like, are you crazy? And then she got up and testified, the old fiance that I brought. Mm-hmm. And when she did that, the new fiance, she had a sweater sitting next to her. She picked it up and threw it, okay, at her, the fireman,
right? Okay.
The Klansman, threw it at him and walked out of the courtroom, okay? Because she knew nothing about that. All she knew was her boyfriend had got into a fight with some black guy. That's all she knew,
mm-hmm.
okay? Nothing about the other woman. And now all of this was exposed in the courtroom. So the judge found him guilty, and he says to the guy, how long will it take you? I understand you're going to pay Mr. Davis. How long will it take you to amass that money? And he almost said, he got ready to say, I have it right here.
Mm.
His attorney cut him off and said, 30 days, Your Honor, and then looked over at me. Because, you know, he was going to punish me. He had it right there. Mm-hmm. He wanted to punish me. Mm-hmm. And so the judge said, okay, that's fine. You have 30 days. And he told the guy to have no contact with me whatsoever. When he got the money, to give it to his attorney and have the attorney send it to me. That way there's no, you know, conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay. And so now we're all walking out. I'm walking out with his ex-fiance. He's right behind me with his attorney. And when we got out of earshot of the judge, right by the exit door, the attorney leans forward to me and says, and it will be 30 days. And I said, hey, you know, I don't care. You know, that money's not going to make me
take all 30.
Right, right. You know?
Right.
So that was my first encounter.
Wow.
Okay.
You know, wow.
One of the things that is so, let me give you a little context in me and Frederick, Maryland. So I there's work that I've done in Frederick within the last few years, and I like it.
It's another world
from DC.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not far. 30-minute ride from the Beltway, and I've actually taken my family there to basically vacation, shall we say, for the weekend.
Okay.
We've gone there, checked in a hotel, looked for restaurants and that sort of thing, and just hung out.
Sure.
Hung out, done nothing. And so to hear all of this going on underneath whatever we were looking at. Yes.
Yeah.
It gives another dimension.
Well, you know, and I don't want to paint Frederick with a broad brush. You know,
that was just
only a couple of incidents.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a while back
mm-hmm.
as well. You know, I mean, places do change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Frederick, you know, had the headquarters, one of the headquarters for the Maryland Ku Klux Klan,
mm-hmm.
that county.
Mm-hmm.
And another headquarters was up in Rising Sun, Maryland.
Okay.
Another one in Baltimore. So, you know, but that is not an indication of the entire town or its population.
It's intense.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, we're well into the interview. I didn't expect to get this far already.
Really?
Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show for you, my brethren, who, like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and the information that will help create loving and flexible parents and partners. I'm Frank Love. And you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us. And if via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get the show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please give us a favorable iTunes rating. And please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We are always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my co-host, Nancy Goldring.
Good morning, Frank.
The consummate generalist.
Indeed.
Today's guest is an American R&B and blues musician. He's an author, actor, and he's also a band leader. He's played with such musicians as Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bruce Hornsby, and Bill Clinton.
Wow.
Although an accomplished musician, it's his efforts to improve race relations that has him with us today. He's an African-American that befriended members of the Ku Klux Klan, including former Imperial Wizard Roger Kelly. So, if you, like me, want to know how he was able to chip away at prejudices and Klan members and how ignorance breeds fear, then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks with the author of Clandestine Relationships, A Black Man's Odyssey in the Ku Klux Klan, Mr. Daryl Davis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we get too deep in today's subject matter, which is, you know, we're well past that, I want to check in to do our segment on what's going on in the news. Brother Davis, please don't be bashful. We certainly want your thoughts, too. And this is, what I'm about to throw out here is, it's perfect to where we've gone so far. And it's, in West Virginia recently, there was a woman who was the head of a federally funded nonprofit.
Okay.
And she sent an email to, I believe, a mayor, the mayor of the town or city or something
Clay,
like
West
that.
Virginia.
Okay. Wow. Saying it's going to be good to have a classy, something to the effect. It's going to be good to have a classy first lady and not that ape.
What
she said was it was going to be good to have a classy first lady, and because she was tired of looking at the ape in heels, that is our current first lady.
Wow!
So I mean, it certainly fits what we're talking about now, and it fits in several ways because your experience is one of education and diplomacy in many ways with the various Klan members that you've interacted with. Is that about right?
That's
Is that
correct.
Safe to say?
And I still interact with them.
Okay. And what I would add to this issue around Michelle Obama, and first I want to say, Michelle Obama's attractive.
And quite classy.
I have met her, and I really think she's a big reason why her husband got elected.
Many people say that.
Really?
Yeah.
She gave him, particularly in the black community.
Right.
She gave
credibility.
Him black credibility.
No,
really, no
question.
I mean, she is a black woman.
Yeah. Got it.
There was not, you know.
Be confused.
Yeah, he could not be confused with Clarence Thomas in the black community.
Got it.
Clarence Thomas has a white wife.
Yes.
And, you know, he's just a different type of person altogether.
Yes.
But it definitely, it adds to a certain story that the black community tells about whoever.
Right.
When you look at the spouse and the family, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Better or worse. So given that, I look at this situation, and the woman that heads the nonprofit, she got fired. And
Makes sense.
I really question whether that's the way to go, to fire someone who has expressed their, she's the woman who was fired says that she's not a racist. And, you know, we can play both sides. Sure, she's okay. not, or, you know, whatever. But I really question whether firing and being as hard as possible on someone who expresses their views that may be racist is the way to go. And I say that because who do you replace her with? Possibly someone who feels the exact same way.
But wouldn't say
it. And just doesn't say it. or doesn't have the mistake of putting it in an email. Doesn't make that mistake. So
email is hot right now. Just let me say that.
I mean, anybody, please weigh in.
I think it may have been a function of her position, and really it's just a matter of where you stand. If you hold a particular position of responsibility, then you're also held to a certain standard of conduct. And many people are not expressing their true views in the positions that they hold because it's just not acceptable protocol given the position they hold. That's like saying that Obama could say whatever he wanted, say, about Netanyahu on the air or in an email, something that was untoward their relationship. He's entitled to think freely. But speaking is a whole other ballgame. And yeah, you have freedom of speech. However, when you hold a certain position of responsibility, you have to conduct yourself accordingly. It's no different than when one of our guests said something to you about swearing. Mm-hmm. And you said, well, ideally we don't, right? Mm-hmm. So you are essentially maintaining that you want your show to be received in a particular way. So we don't swear. It's not that we can't. And that's minor. Or don't, you know. But it's not where we find ourselves every week.
Well, I'll add another component. First, I mean, I don't have a problem with Clarence Thomas having a white wife. I just have a problem with Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
In general,
and his,
right.
And his beliefs and his attitudes. Mm-hmm. You know, Obama was the product of an interracial marriage, mm-hmm. and I have no problem with that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But as far as firing the woman, I have no problem with her believing what she wants to believe, whether I disagree with it or not, mm-hmm. is irrelevant. But I think because she brought shame on her workplace, perhaps her company did not support that kind of attitude, and now they are you know, they're a nonprofit, you know, they work on the borderline trying to make money, mm-hmm. and so they rely upon donors,
right,
to fund them, mm-hmm. and here's some woman, you know, painting a bad image. People think, I'm not giving my money to that place.
Right.
Well, mm-hmm. it's not that place, it's that woman, but people perceive it because she brought shame on the whole nonprofit.
Wow.
So, you know, when you represent somebody, sometimes you need to keep your opinions to yourself, and she didn't do it.
She mm-hmm. wasn't speaking so, as a private citizon.
Exactly. And as far as we know, perhaps everybody at that nonprofit feels that way,
yeah.
but they don't express that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that they do, but she did, and she brought shame on the company, and they had a right to get rid of her because she marred their... You know, their progress. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like a police officer. I mean, he may feel one way about us on the street when he pulls us over, but he must conduct himself another way. although many of them don't.
I don't know. Theoretically.
That's a whole different discussion.
What you got, Jeff?
No, I agree wholeheartedly. Mm. I mean, she's gone. She should be gone. You're in a position of responsibility. You need to discipline yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, everything that was just said, I totally agree with.
How do we get to the point where we know, or should we get to the point where we know what another person thinks, if it's racially charged or quote unquote racist, and can talk about it without it penalizing their workplace or, you know, their how they make their bread and butter?
We get rid of several things. One, we get rid of political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
That has caused people to walk around on eggshells fearing they might say something that might be offensive and then start a whole war with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So they just shut up and don't have the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
We have a taboo that has been imposed upon the conversation of race. That taboo needs to be lifted. Back when I was in junior high school, sex ed was being introduced,
mm-hmm.
and which was a taboo.
Yeah.
You know, parents did not teach their kids about sex, and they didn't want their teachers teaching their kids about sex.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? The kids are going to learn it anyway out on the street,
right?
And probably the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they were trying to introduce it into the school system, and initially, you know, if you were going to have your kid take sex ed, you had to sign a note mm-hmm. giving
yep.
him permission.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Today, it's part of the general curriculum, all right? It's there in your health class, your PE class, which is a lot because the taboo has been lifted.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of lifting that taboo, kids are more informed today about STDs, family planning, contraception, venereal disease, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they can make better decisions and better choices because that taboo has been lifted and now they have the information. Information is power. That same taboo has been imposed upon the discussion of race in this country. And
absolutely.
It needs to be lifted so that we all can feel free to talk about it. And yes, you know, we're going to make some mistakes. We're going to be offensive, whatever. But it's more important that we all be honest, all of us,
mm-hmm.
on both sides, turn all cards face up and express what we think about the other people, what fears we may have, what superiorities we may think we have,
mm-hmm.
whatever, and then address them that way
mm-hmm.
rather than just harbor them and let them come out anytime there's an incident.
But then that kind of runs counter to this idea that the woman should have lost her job. So what you're really saying is that there's a platform or a forum in with wherein we can responsibly discuss these issues. And one of them is not in your inter-office email.
Right.
Because she essentially was saying what she thought.
Right.
She was lifting the taboo. I don't know that she was lifting the taboo, but she was operating within the taboo, actually. And that's what got her fired.
But companies have certain policies.
Sure.
You know, like, you know, you can't be dating one of your fellow employees or something like that.
Yeah,
because, you know, if something goes wrong, then you know, you all can't do your job right, that kind of thing. So, I mean, in the workplace, there are certain rules and regulations, you know, that you have to abide by. You can't do anything that's going to bring shame on your company.
Right.
Or be involved in anything subversive, you know, that's going to be found out.
But that doesn't mean the conversation shouldn't be had. And
exactly.
I really think that that's
exactly.
a lot of what's going to come with the Trump administration. It's already. I mean, if anybody lifted the taboo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in some regards, that Donald Trump is the best thing that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did not support his candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the things he said were ridiculous and stupid and racist, and he stirred the pot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, though, that him being in that position has caused people to come out of the closet, come out from under the rug, and out from under the rock. And now that conversation can start. Because sometimes, you know, you got to go to the very bottom. You got to break something
mm-hmm.
right.
in order to repair it. Because for the last 100 years, all we've been doing is putting Band-Aids on
right.
the wounds,
right.
not getting down to the bone. You know, it's sort of like you go skiing and you know, you might fracture your leg or something. And you go to the doctor and he says, well, you know, I need to break the bone and reset it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's breaking the bone. And this time when we reset it, we need to build from afresh and get it right,
mm-hmm.
not just keep addressing the wound.
And what does get it right look like?
Right.
get it right is start off on a platform of equality, okay, where everybody can talk freely mm-hmm. and express their beliefs, express their concerns, and have them addressed. Okay, and we've never had that in this country. We've never had, you know, we talk about everybody else's country. Whenever another country is getting ready to have a civil war, we intervene and try to bring both parties together at a summit. Let's talk about this. But yet we don't have those summits in our own country when we are divisive. Right now we are in a global fishbowl. Every other country is looking at us and laughing. Because we are so hypocritical. Mm-hmm. You know, we're telling everybody else how to run their country. You know, the Sunnis need to meet with the Shiites. Mm-hmm. Well, how come blacks and whites are not meeting here? How come we're not taking care of our own backyard before telling somebody else what to do? One of the things that I think, and I've been saying this now for 14 years, and there'll be people who agree with me, people who disagree with me, but that's okay. I think what we need to do in this country at this point in time is get rid of Black History Month. And I'll tell you why. For the longest time, we had no Black history in schools. What we had was called American history. Mm-hmm. For all practical purposes, it may as well have been called white history, because that's exactly what it was. And in many instances, white people were being given credit for things that they did not discover and for things that they did not invent. We knew it, okay, and we were taught it at home, but it was not being taught in our textbooks, all right? So we fought and we fought and we fought. Finally, we got 1 week, and mm-hmm. it was called Negro History Week, mm-hmm. okay? And then we fought and fought and fought some more. Finally, we got a month, February, the shortest month of the year, but also because February was the birthday month of two people that Black people admired, Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, yeah. All right? Then we became complacent. We stopped fighting. We got our month, all right? Here's the problem now. During the month of February, every February, we learn about a half a dozen Black people. Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, Charles Drew, maybe one or two other ones, and then we're done. Mm-hmm. We move on. And up, you know, we did our Black thing, let's move on. Mm-hmm. And we never revisit any of those people again until the following February. And every February, it's the same half a dozen people. Mm-hmm. So subliminally, we are brainwashing little white boys and girls and little Black boys and girls into believing there was only a handful of Black people in this country that ever did anything. What about the guy who invented the traffic light? The guy who invented the ironing board? You know, all kinds of other things. Oh, well, we didn't have time. You know, we only have February. Mm-hmm. But yet we study Benjamin Franklin, Eli Whitney, Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, on and on and on, all year long. We never forget what any of those people did. You know, who flew the kite and the lightning hit the key? We all know it's Ben Franklin.
Right.
But when you only study people in February and never reinforce it throughout the year, you ask some little kid, okay, so who in June? Who was Harriet Tubman? Mm-hmm. And they think, oh, yeah, she was that lady who didn't give up her seat on the bus.
Because, oh, wow.
Because they're confused.
Wow.
Because there was no reinforcement.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Okay? And so you're brainwashing them to thinking, you know, there's only a handful of Black people that ever did anything. Mm-hmm. So now, like I said, there was a time when we needed Black History Month. All right? But today, you know, we should be fighting to get rid of it and put that information that we teach in February where it belongs, under the umbrella of American history,
yeah.
Where it belongs, because that's what it is, and teach it all year long, all right? Women's History Month, same thing, is March. Mm-hmm. Get rid of that. Teach about women throughout the year, you know? Call it American history. There was a time when Black women were not allowed to compete in the Miss America beauty pageant. They were not deemed beautiful. Mm-hmm. And at the time, all the judges were white males. Mm-hmm. And there were only two categories, the evening gown and the swimsuit.
The evening suit,
because
yeah.
Women did not have any talent. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, that was the attitude.
Or opinion.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, there were no, have them write an essay or show some talent that they had. Mm-hmm. That was the mindset. No, they're just being judged on what they look like. Sex objects, all right? So they did not want white men on a panel judging the beauty of a black woman. So black women were not allowed to compete. All right. So black, because they were deemed not beautiful enough, right? Mm. That gave black women low self-esteem because they were not being ranked. All right. So what did we do to correct that? We black people, created the Miss Black America pageant to give black women that uplift, that self-esteem, right? Mm-hmm. Over the years, finally, Miss America came to their senses, and they opened the doors to all American females, regardless of their color, as long as they were American. And since that time, we've had several Miss Americas who've been black, starting with Vanessa Williams and then Debbie Turner or whoever, right? Mm-hmm. So now we no longer need Miss Black America because Miss America has opened the doors. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to do with Black History Month. It needs to be part of American history. President Obama, the first black president of the United States, he's out of office in days. in days, okay? So as backwards as we are in this country, what are we going to do from here on out? Only study Obama in February, put him in the black box?
Oh, my goodness.
It doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Have we not come far enough? Mm. That's my opinion.
Okay. You certainly have one.
I don't think you're going to need to worry about it because Donald Trump's going to make it a weekend.
Yeah. Okay.
And not even a three-day one, yeah, right? Yeah.
Tell me how you ended up interviewing Klan's members.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I had my secretary, who's white, mm-hmm. and I only mentioned that not that it matters to me, but because it's a part of my story. Mm-hmm. I got the leader's name. I wanted to interview Klan leaders all over the country, mm-hmm. Klan leaders and members, and the guy from the Silver Dollar Lounge.
Yeah.
Okay. He and I became friends, mm-hmm. and it was hard to persuade him, but I finally did. To give me the Klan leader's name, phone number, and address. Mm-hmm. Well, I knew his name. I knew his phone number and address. Mm-hmm. And he gave it to me on the condition that I not reveal to this guy where I got it.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay. So he warned me. He said, do not go to his house. He'll kill you. And, wow. And he gave me the name of a place where the Klan would hang out up there in Frederick, mm-hmm. public place. He says, you're safer to approach him there. Mm-hmm. I would not guarantee you that he'll speak to you, but you're better off seeing him in a public place than going on his property. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. So anyway, I did go to that place, and he wasn't there that particular time. So I had
what happened with the people in terms of the people who were there?
Nothing happened. Everything was fine. Mm-hmm. I had my secretary call him, and I told her specifically, do not tell Mr. Kelly
I'm black.
That I'm black, mm-hmm. okay? Because I figure, if I called him, and I'm the one who had his phone number, mm-hmm. if I called him, he might pick up in my voice that I'm black.
Right.
And say, I'm not talking to you, click. And then my whole project would have ended before it even got started.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I knew, because I have just about every book written on the Klan, and mm-hmm. I've read them all. Mm-hmm. And they're all written by white authors, except for two books written by black authors, just had chapters that dealt with the Klan, but they dealt with it from the perspective of each person escaping a lynching. Mm-hmm. One in the 1930s, James mm-hmm. Cameron, and the other one in the 1940s, Walter White.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay? But not from the perspective of sitting down and speaking face-to-face mm-hmm. with their would-be lynchers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Of course, so all the other books were written by white authors who had access to the Klan. They didn't have to fear retribution, mm-hmm. or they could join the Klan undercover, mm-hmm. get the story, get out, and write about it.
Right.
Or ex-Klansmen, ex-Klanswomen, who write their memoirs. So anyway, I knew from the mentality that if she called, they would know this is a white woman by her voice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they would also not automatically assume that this white woman was working for a black man. Mm-hmm. Especially a black man who's writing a book on the Klan, because they didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason to go there. Mm-hmm. And so she understood, and I said, if he asks what color I am, don't lie to him. Tell him. But don't allude to it. Don't give him reason, because I want him to agree to it. And then if he agrees to it, and he agrees to meet me, well, then obviously he'll see what color I am, mm-hmm. and he can decide right then and there. I want it to be spontaneous. Plus, if he knew what color I was in advance, and he still agreed to do the interview, he might prepare different answers for a black interviewer than he would prepare for a white interviewer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wanted to mitigate all that. Mm-hmm. And so she understood. She called him, and he didn't ask what color I was, mm-hmm. and he agreed to do the interview. So that's how that started. And of course, when he showed up,
he figured it out. Was he visibly shocked?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Okay, so he had a bodyguard?
He had a bodyguard. And we set it up for this motel room up in Frederick. Mm-hmm. And Mary, my secretary, and I got there early, several hours early, because whenever, you know, a higher up in the clan, like a Grand Dragon or Imperial Wizard, is going to appear, they send out their scouts in advance to check things out and make sure everything's cool, and then before they bring the guy. Mm-hmm. So she and I got there way in advance, so before any scouts would ever get there. Mm-hmm. Got the room. I gave her some money and sent her down the hall to get some soda pop out of the machine, put it in a bucket of ice, so I would be able to be, you know, hospitable and offer you know, Mr. Kelly a beverage. I had no idea what he was going to do when he saw me. Mm-hmm. Was he going to freak out and attack me? Was he going to say, I'm not talking to you, turn around and walk away? Mm-hmm. Or was he going to come in, sit down, and do what we agreed to do? Mm-hmm. But in any event, I wanted to be hospitable.
Yeah.
So I had all these beverages, soda pop in the bucket of ice. And the way the room was situated just happened to be, if you're standing in the hallway, you cannot see who's in the room until you come in, turn the corner, and then the room is laid out back there. So I took a lamp table and took the lamp off and put it in the corner of the room. And I put a chair on one side for Mr. Kelly, a chair on the other side for me, all in the hopes, you know, he would come in and do what he's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And I had a bag next to my chair. In my bag, a little suitcase bag, duffel bag, I had a copy of the Bible, because the Ku Klux Klan claims to be a Christian organization, and they claim that the Bible itself preaches racial separation. Okay. And so I wanted to be able to pull out my Bible and say, here, show me where it says blacks and whites need to be separate, because I've read the Bible, I've never seen that. I had a cassette player, which I set in the middle of the table, and some blank cassettes in the bag. So I'm all ready, right? Mm-hmm. So right at 5:15, the appointed time, there's like a knock on the door. And Mary hops up and runs around the corner, opens the door. And in walks the bodyguard, otherwise known as a Nighthawk. Mm-hmm. And he's wearing camouflage military fatigues. He has the Ku Klux Klan insignia, which is a red circle, the white cross and blood drop in the center, on his chest on one side. On the other side were the initials KKK. Mm-hmm. And he had a little beret on his head, embroidered, it said Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And on his hip, he had a semi-automatic handgun in a holster, you know, visible. Mm-hmm. And so he comes in, and Mr. Kelly is walking directly behind him in a dark blue suit and tie. Mm-hmm. And when the Nighthawk turned the corner and saw me, he, like, stopped short, just, like, froze. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Kelly did not realize that his Nighthawk had stopped, and he slammed into his back. And they stumbled and, you know, tripped and had to, you know, regain their balance and look all around the room like, something's not right here. Well, I knew what was not right. You know, they're looking for a white guy.
Right.
And so I got up and I exposed both of my hands, palms up, so he could see I had nothing in my hands. And I approached him. I said, hi, Mr. Kelly. I said, my name is Daryl Davis. And I put my hand out. He shook my hand. Mm-hmm. The Nighthawk shook my hand. Mm-hmm. So far, so good. I said, come on in, have a seat. And Mr. Kelly sat down. Mm-hmm. And the Nighthawk stood at attention to his right. Mm-hmm. And then right before I could sit down opposite him, Mr. Kelly says to me, Mr. Davis, do you have any form of identification? I said, sure. So I pulled out my driver's license and I handed it to him. And he said, oh, you live on such and such a street in Silver Spring. Well, now that had me a little unsettled. Mm-hmm. You know, I just thought he was just going to look at my name, look at my face, and look at my picture on the license, and give it back. You know, he's reading my address. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh, you know, I don't want this guy coming to my house and burning a cross in my yard or whatever. But I didn't want to let him know that he had unsettled me a little bit. But I wanted to let him know, don't come and pull any shenanigans. So I said, yes, Mr. Kelly, that is where I live. And you live at. Mm. And I recited his house number and his street. Mm-hmm. So I was leveling the playing field.
Sure.
In other words, if you come visit me, I might come visit you. Mm-hmm. And I'll bring the cops, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he smiled, nodded his head like he understood. But I was being presumptuous that day, and I didn't find that out until many months later. I had no reason to fear Mr. Kelly. What it was this. one of his Klan members lived right down the road from me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Wow.
And Mr. Kelly would have to travel down my street to get to that guy's house. Mm-hmm. So he recognized the street. It was just pure coincidence. But there was no way I could have known that at that particular moment.
Yeah.
All right. So I found that out many months later. Anyway, that same Klan member today sits in a federal prison in the state of Maine for committing a hate crime. So he's there for a while.
The one that lived on your street.
Yeah, not on my street, but down my street. Yeah,
yeah.
And off right off my street. Anyway, so we got into this interview. He let me know that he was superior to me, mm-hmm. And black people in general, mm-hmm. and that he felt that blacks and whites need to be separate. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're why didn't I go back to Africa? And I'm like, well, why don't you go back to Europe? Mm-hmm. And he says, well, because, he was here voluntarily. I didn't come here voluntarily. I was brought here. I said, yeah, I was brought here. And he goes, well, now you're free and you're free to go back. I said, well, I'm also free to stay,
Yeah.
So, that went back and forth for a while. Nobody got, rude or violent. Every now and then got a little loud. Mm-hmm. Okay. But every time he would say, Mr. Davis, the Bible says, I'd reach down into my bag and produced the King James Version of the Bible. Mm-hmm. I said, Mr. Kelly, show me where, chapter and verse. Or if my cassette player ran out of tape, I'd reach down, grab a fresh cassette. Every time I reached down to get something out of my bag, the Nighthawk would reach up to his gun,
mm-hmm.
right? And I understood that. He didn't know what I had in the bag. Mm-hmm. And so after a while, he relaxed, and I went in and out of the bag. There was no problems. Mm-hmm. A little over an hour into this interview, there was kind of a strange noise in the room, and we all jumped. And I didn't know what that noise was, but I knew that Mr. Kelly had made that noise because I didn't make it. Mm-hmm. So I'm, process of elimination, right? If I didn't make it, he had to have done it. And because I could not detect what the noise was, I perceived it to be like an ominous noise. A threatening noise, mm-hmm. and I was hearing the other Klansman's voice in my head, mm-hmm. Daryl, don't fool with Roger Kelly. Roger Kelly will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, he was an ex-Klansman by the time he had given me this information.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I said I didn't say anything to him. I came up out of my chair, and I put my hands on the table. I'm looking right into his face, because I'm getting ready to come across that table, and grab him and the Nighthawk.
Mm-hmm.
And slam them down to the ground and take away the Nighthawk's gun. Because I had gone into what you call survival mode.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And, when you fear for your life, you do whatever you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And people will generally do one of three things when they go into that mode. Some people just freeze and tense up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be hitting them on the head with a baseball bat. And they will not be deflecting the blows. They'll just stand there shaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called paralysis by fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're too scared to move. Other people will try to run away from the source of the fear, which is the best option. If you can distance yourself from it, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to be outrunning a bullet in a motel room.
Right.
So the third option is to attack
right.
the source of fear and put it down. And so that's what I was about to do. But when I came up out of my chair, and Mr. Kelly's face and my face were a little closer than yours and mine are right now, across the table, and I was looking into his eyes. I didn't say a word, but my eyes were speaking to him, and I knew he could read my eyes. My eyes were saying to him, what did you just do? Mm-hmm. And his eyes, as I'm looking into his eyes, I could tell, and I could read his eyes. His eyes were asking me the same question.
Mm-hmm.
What did I just do?
Mm-hmm.
And that told me he was not the source of this noise.
Mm-hmm.
And the bodyguard had his hand on his gun, still inside the hole. He never drew it. He had it on the handle of his gun,
mm-hmm.
looking back and forth between both of us like, what did either one of y'all just do?
Well, wow.
Mary, she was sitting on top of the dresser because, there were no more chairs in the room, and she realized what happened. The ice in the ice bucket had melted.
It shifted.
And the cans of soda shifted.
Yeah.
And then it made that same noise again. And we all began laughing at how ignorant we all had been.
Yeah,
we're enemies. He's the head of the Klan. I'm a black guy. But we were in the same motel room, all right, talking, agreeing, disagreeing, at some points laughing. And this was a teaching moment.
Mm-hmm.
A lesson was taught. I won't say that the lesson was learned in that moment, mm-hmm. but it was taught. Mm-hmm. And the lesson being, all because some foreign entity of which mm-hmm. we were ignorant, and underline the word foreign or underscore mm-hmm. it, circle it, that being the bucket of ice and cans of soda of which we were ignorant, mm-hmm. entered into our little comfort zone via the noise that it made.
You were ready to attack each other.
Yeah, we became fearful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The lesson taught is ignorance breeds fear. Mm-hmm. If you do not keep that fear in check, that fear in turn will breed hatred because we hate those things that frighten us. Mm-hmm. If you do not keep that hatred in check, that hatred in turn will breed destruction. We mm-hmm. want to destroy those things that we hate. Why? Mm-hmm. Because they frighten us, but guess what? They may have been harmless, and we were just ignorant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was a teaching moment, mm-hmm. and that was the planting of a seed mm-hmm. that was later, you know, nurtured. Mm-hmm. But at the end of, we carried on an interview. There were no more problems. Mm-hmm. At the end of the interview, I thanked Mr. Kelly for his time and the Nighthawk. I shook their hands, and they wished me luck. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Kelly gave me his Klan card. Mm-hmm. And said, keep in touch. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a really? Minute, you know, I didn't say this, but I'm thinking to myself, I didn't come here to make friends.
Right.
I came here to find out, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? Mm-hmm. But what I said to him was, thank you, Mr. Kelly. You know, I have a lot of other Klan people to interview. When my book is ready for publication, I will, get in touch with you.
Yeah.
And so he wished me luck, and they left. And then on the way back down 270, back to Montgomery County, I said to Mary, in my car, I said, you know, I rather like Roger Kelly. Mm. And she like jumped and said, well, he doesn't like you. I said, yeah, I know. I said, I don't like what he stands for, but I like him as a person. Mm. We have more in common than we do in contrast. Most of what we had in contrast centered around how we each felt about race. Mm. He felt that his race was superior to my race. I felt that mine was equal to his. He felt that the races had to be apart. I felt they could be together. But other than that, we agreed on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I said to her, I said, you know what? I am going to stay in contact with him. And so I did. Mm-hmm. And I would call him from time to time. If I had to go up to Frederick to drop off a music contract or a CD or something like that mm-hmm. for some bar where I was going to play. And I'd call him and say, hey, man, you know, what are you doing? And if he said he wasn't doing anything, I said, well, come go with me on this errand. He'd say, okay, I'll meet you at wherever. He always wanted to meet me somewhere. He didn't want me coming to his house, right? Uh-huh. So we'd meet at the park and ride off of 270. Mm-hmm. I'd get there. He and the Nighthawk would already be there. Mm-hmm. Nighthawk would get in my back seat. Mr. Kelly get in my front seat. And we'd ride around Frederick County and do what I had to do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would stop off and have lunch. Now, here we are, sitting at the same table. I'm not going to sit over here because I'm black. He's going to sit over there because he's a Klansman. Mm-hmm. We sat at the same table. Mm-hmm. We took mozzarella sticks out of the same basket. We used the same salt and pepper shaker, the same ketchup bottle. All right? Not my first time. I've done it 1,000 times. Mm. But his first time. Okay? Yeah. Because he does not socialize.
With black men.
Exactly. Black now, he has to work with them on his job. I mean, you know, because he has to draw a paycheck to pay his mortgage or put food on his table. Mm-hmm. Right? But, you know, when he's off work, he doesn't go out to happy hour with these people. Mm-hmm. He goes out with his own kind. But here he was sitting with me. I would invite him down to my house. He would come an hour and a half away. Mm-hmm. He'd come to my house. He'd bring his Nighthawk, right? The Nighthawk sometimes would sit on the couch next to him, get bored, and pull out his gun and just twirl it on his finger, right? Mr. Kelly and I would talk. Sometimes I would invite over some of my other black friends, some of my white friends, some of my Jewish friends, just to allow him to engage in conversation with someone else other than me. Mm-hmm. I did not want him to think, oh, well, Daryl is an exception. Right. No. You know, maybe his beliefs are the exception, right? We would even have dinner at my table or lunch at my table or go out and have lunch. Now, this is somebody who felt superior to me, but yet he's going to dine with me. And this went on for a couple of years. By the end of I'd never been invited to his house at this point. By the end of a couple of years, he was coming down to my house by himself. Mm-hmm. No Nighthawk.
I was going to ask you when.
He trusted me that much. I even took him down to Howard University.
Wow.
Okay, which you know is a predominantly black school.
I do happen to know that. Yes.
Which is where I graduated from.
Me too.
Right? I took him down there to see somebody, and show him where I went to school. You know, And he trusted me, mm-hmm. okay? And I'm his only protection. Mm-hmm. So anyway, after a couple years, he was elevated from Grand Dragon, state leader. Okay, let me just give you the hierarchy of how the Klan works. Today, there is no such thing as the Ku Klux Klan. There are okay. many Ku Klux Klan groups.
Okay.
Okay? There's no Ku Klux Klan central. There mm-hmm. used to be, mm-hmm. and there'd be chapters of that one central all over the place. Mm-hmm. Today, there are all these chapters which are autonomous.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They don't report to a central.
Okay.
Okay? And they all use the same secret password, the same handshake, mm-hmm. the same colors on their robe that designate their rank, the same bylaws, same titles. Mm-hmm. But they are rivals with one another.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay? So if you have a chapter of your, and they all use the name Ku Klux Klan. You might have the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Dixie Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Territorial Knights, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. These are all separate Klan groups. Mm-hmm. If you see any of them, the different ones, together in public, they will hold a unified front.
Mm-hmm.
But behind closed doors, they are at each other's throats.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So anyway, if you have a chapter of your particular Klan group in another state, or in multiple states, you may then consider yourself to be a national Klan group.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Roger Kelly had 13 states.
Mm-hmm.
And if you become a national Klan group, you must therefore have a national leader who oversees all the states. We call our national leader the president.
Mm-hmm.
In Klan terminology, that individual is known as the Imperial Wizard.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anybody who is prefixed with the term Imperial means they are a national officer. Mm-hmm. So a wizard is a top, mm-hmm. like a president. An imperial claylif is like a vice president. And then you have and you have secretaries and treasurers and all that kind of stuff. All right. And then the next level will be state level.
Mm-hmm.
A state leader, which we call the governor, they call theirs the Grand Dragon. Anybody grand is a state officer. Dragon is a top state officer. A grand claylif would be like a lieutenant governor.
Mm-hmm.
Within the state, you have counties. We call the county executive. They call that person the Great Titan. Anybody mm-hmm. great is on the county level.
Mm-hmm.
Under the county, you have districts. We call a district leader like a mayor, a councilman, an alderman. That individual is known as an exalted cyclops. And at every level, there's a secretary and treasurer and on and on.
An exalted cyclops.
Yeah. See, these names come from, the original Klan, when it was first formed, it was formed by six Confederate soldiers down in Pulaski, Tennessee. And they were of Irish and Scottish descent, and they came from the Scottish Rite, the Masons.
Got it.
And the Masons have all these mm-hmm. strange names and things, secret organization. So now that's not to say that Masons are Klan members. Mm-hmm. Some are, yes,
sure. mm-hmm.
but not all Klan are Masons, all right? So I don't want to paint the Masons, you know, in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they borrowed a lot mm-hmm. of the secrecy and the strange names and applied it to their own. And then they for as racist as they are, they use some foreign things to name some of their items. Like the word Ku Klux Klan is a combination of Irish and Greek. The word Kuklos, Kuklos, it means circle mm-hmm. in Greek.
Okay.
The word clan is spelled with a C normally, right? C-L-A-N, which is an Irish-Scottish word for family.
Right.
You know, I would come from the Davis clan, you know. So you would come from the Love clan, mm-hmm. all right? What they did was they took the word Kuklos, and apparently they couldn't spell Greek, and they spelled it K-U-K-L-U-X, mm-hmm. Ku Klux. And they took the word clan and changed the C to a K for uniformity, K-K-K. So Ku Klux Klan means circle of family, circle of close friends. All right. So the Confederate generals, formed that back in 1865 mm-hmm. Down in Pulaski. But then they, you know, over years, that central broke up mm-hmm. over arguments, infighting, and that kind of stuff. You had all these splinter groups.
Mm-hmm.
So each one would have an imperial wizard, a grand dragon, and so forth and so on, all the way down to just plain rank yeah. and file who just wear the plain white robes.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, when Roger Kelly became Imperial Wizard, national leader, he began inviting me to his house.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go to his house. I would see his Klan den where he'd have his meetings. I would take some notes. And now, you know, this whole time, you know, I was interviewing other Klan people too around the country. Uh-huh. Some of them would talk to me, some of them would not talk to me, some want to fight, all that kind of crazy stuff.
Okay, right? So how did when you say you were interviewing them, how were you interviewing people that didn't want to talk? What was that relationship or interaction?
If they didn't want to talk, then I couldn't interview them.
Okay.
And I just let them go.
And then the fighting, how did that, what was that like?
Well, I mean, I didn't go to fight, but sometimes, you know, when I would show up, some of them would freak out and want to fight.
So they didn't know you were black?
Some of them did not know I was black. Okay. But one guy did, and he attacked me, and I had to hurt
him. Put him down.
And put him down, right? And the police put him in jail. Mm-hmm. And a lady, she attacked me, and I...
A lady
A lady, yeah, a lady Klanswoman.
Wow.
And I had her arrested.
Okay.
And took him to court, and I beat them there as well.
Mm-hmm. Did Roger ever... a list of people to where he kind of paved the way for you to go in?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he did, as a matter of fact. And I'll tell you something funny. But let me finish the story about Roger. So he invites me to his house. And I would go. And he was very cordial, showed me a lot of things, helped me, you know, get the information that I needed from my book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a very good, you know, relationship. And then he would invite me to Klan rallies. Mm-hmm. And I would go to these things. And one of the times when I came to a rally, right, you know, they're surrounded by police, mm-hmm. because, you know, there're gonna be protesters outside, da 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 da. Mm-hmm. And I came, the cops didn't want to let me in, and but they had to let me in because he invited me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the Klan gave me a standing ovation when I walked in. Mm-hmm. They all stood up in their robes and hoods, yeah, and applauded, and I sat on the front row, right, and then I see these, you know, cross lightings. You know, they light this big cross on fire at their rallies and proclaim, you know, white power and for God, for race, for country. Mm-hmm. They have. Let me define first of all. There are two occasions upon which the Klan sets a cross aflame. You have what's called a cross burning, and you have what's called a cross lighting. Mm-hmm. A cross burning is when they take a 5 or 10 foot cross that has been wrapped in burlap, which has been soaked in what they call Klan cologne, mm-hmm. which is actually diesel fuel,
oil,
kerosene.
Yeah.
Okay. And they stick it in your yard, mm-hmm. and set it on fire. Mm-hmm. That is meant as a threat or intimidation, because you're a black family in a white neighborhood, you're an interracial family, you're Jewish, you're homosexual, mm-hmm. whatever they're opposed to. Mm-hmm. That is meant to warn you. We know who you are. Move out. Because if we come back again, you're going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. We mean business. Mm-hmm. So that's called a cross burning. Mm-hmm. It's your first warning. Mm-hmm. All right. When they have a ceremony, a rally, and they light the cross is 20 or 30 feet high. Mm-hmm. And that's called a cross lighting.
Okay.
So, you know, so I went some of those and you know, saw how that works and listened to all these, you know, racist speeches, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, he provided me a lot of insight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not everybody was as cooperative
as him. Right.
Sure.
And I really appreciate, you know, those things that he did. And I needed a Klanswoman. I've been interviewing all these men, and I've seen some Klanswomen, but I didn't really know them, you know. Mm-hmm. So I said to him, I said, listen, I've got enough men that I've interviewed. I need a Klanswoman to sit down and talk to me. Can you provide me one of your Klans ladies? He says, let me see what I can do. So he called me back. He says, yeah, I got somebody for you. He says, but this is funny. He says, she hates black people more than I do.
Wow.
That's what he told me.
Right? Wow. Meanwhile, you guys are friends.
Exactly.
Okay? Right.
This is what I'm talking about. This is the conversations that we need to have where people can feel free to say what they want to say,
sure.
Okay, without, you know, fear of retaliation,
right.
Or, you know, and people understand. So he says, she hates black people more than I do, and she wants, she does not want to meet you in public. She wants you to come to her house.
Interesting.
So now this did not make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Well, if she hates blacks more than he does or whatever.
She didn't want to be seen in public with you.
She didn't want to be seen in public with me. Mm-hmm. She wanted me to come to her house. So I'm thinking, well, how is this going to work? Suppose somebody driving by happens to see me on her porch going mm-hmm. to the house or leaving or whatever. You know, they're going to, you know.
Claim you were an attacker.
Or claim, you know, whatever, paint a bad picture of her.
Right.
So he goes, no, you don't have to worry about that. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, just give her a call. You know, when you get there, you'll see. So I'm thinking, I trusted the guy. So I said, okay. So he gave me her phone number.
She's 100.
No, she's not 100. So
she's black, too. No.
In the spirit of Dave Chappelle.
Oh, so, no, that's what I'm thinking.
So I call her, and she's, you know, she agrees, you know, to do this thing, and she gives me directions to her house.
Okay.
Right? So I drive up there. Her driveway is through the woods, mm-hmm. a quarter mile back. Mm-hmm. You can't see anything from the street. Mm-hmm. So, like, whoa, okay. Yeah. This is in the evening, too, right?
Right.
And I check this out. This is interesting. I get there, and you know, she opens the door and welcomes me in, and there is a small keyboard, piano-type, you know, music keyboard, on her coffee table. And I said, oh, do you play? Because, you know, I play. And she goes, well, I just fool around with it or whatever. I said, oh. And I said, are you a musician? And she said, well, I used to be, da-da-da. And I said, oh, yeah. And then she started telling me. And I remembered, you know, I'd never seen her before, but I remembered her record. Her records, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, you have a copy? And she played it for me. And I said, well, later on, you know, you're going to I'll have to sing that song for me. She goes, well, I can't play it like that. I said, well, let me hear it again, and I can play it. Mm-hmm. And she goes, you can listen to it and play it? I said, sure. So so we got on with this interview.
Good night.
And we talked, and, you know it was a great interview. You know, she did not like black people, mm-hmm. you know, and... she thought we were inferior, and we always caused problems, and Martin Luther King was the one who caused all the riots of 68 and burned down the towns, you know, the whole nine yards.
Right.
And so, but I was getting all this information, and then when I finished, I said, so, you know, we're going to do this? She goes, yeah, I want to hear you play. So I started playing a little bit on her little keyboard, and she says, do you want to use a real piano? I look around. I don't see a real piano here. I said, well, you got one? And she goes, yeah, because I'm used to 88 keys. This thing was like a little Casio or something. And she goes, come on. Where do I go? Into her bedroom. Now, we're talking
and
midnight.
You went?
Yeah. We're talking like midnight. I got there somewhere around 7:30 for this interview. And you know, we were in the living room around 11:30 fooling around with this little keyboard. And when she said she had a real piano, now it's about 10 minutes of midnight or something. Mm-hmm. I go into her bedroom. There is no, the piano is facing the wall right across from the foot of her bed. There was no bench because there was no way to pass between the bed and the piano if there was a bench there. So she would have to sit on the foot of her bed to play the piano. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting on the foot of this Klanswoman's bed at midnight playing this piano. All right? And
Called a compromising position.
We played songs. Well, she was astonished that I knew country music. Mm-hmm. But see, I played country, you know, back in the 80s, right, at the Silver Dollar Lounge.
Right.
I played songs. She sang them. We played Patsy Cline, Tammy Wynette, Loretta Lynn, Hank Williams, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. You Were Cheating Heart, you name it, Crazy, I Fall to Pieces, all this stuff. And we're having a good old time.
Did y'all have a gooder old time?
No.
This is the Frank Love show.
It does get better, though. So anyway.
How do you get better?
I realize, oh my goodness, you know, it's closing in on 1 a.m. Mm. I'm out here in the woods, and I need to go home. You know, I've done my interview and played my songs. So she gave me a copy of her record, and she walked me out to the porch, and I thanked her. And she went to hug me. But I'd already put my hand out. And I think she like caught herself, like realized, oh, I can't hug you. You know? But had I not had my hand out, we would have hugged. Uh-huh. Okay? And anyway, so I left. I kept in contact with her. I get a Christmas card from her every year. Every year. All right? And she sends me questions for advice on this or the other. Well, guess what? About 3 months ago, I called her up. And I said, you know, there's a national country band. You know, they're very well known nationally, and they're good friends of mine. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, you know, would she like to go to the concert with me? I said, you know, take you out to dinner, take you to this concert. And she goes, yeah. So I went to her house, picked her up, and took her out.
Gosh.
And had dinner and a concert with her.
What?
Yeah.
All right.
Publicly?
Publicly, yeah.
So, okay, but she wasn't like a grand or an imperial or a Cyclops.
She just hated black people.
She just hated,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but she
realized that's enough.
She's modifying.
Sufficient, yeah.
She's modifying a little right. bit. Uh-huh. Now, today I own Roger Kelly's robe and hood. He's no longer in the Klan. I have a bunch of robes and hoods at my house that were given to me by active Klan members, you know, since coming to know me. They have rescinded their beliefs.
I was really not everybody. Did it change anybody?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not everybody. There are going to be people who will go to their graves being hateful and
right,
violent.
Right,
but there
right.
are those who begin thinking. Because, you know, you have people who are ignorant and you have people who are stupid.
Sure.
And some people define ignorance and stupidity as being synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
To right. me, an ignorant person is someone who makes the wrong doesn't decision mm-hmm. because he or she doesn't have the proper facts
mm-hmm.
to make the right decision. A stupid person has the facts, but still makes the wrong decision, right? So people begin thinking and rethinking. And it's not an overnight switch. It's a gradual thing. The problem that I see today in our society is that this person will talk to CNN about that person. That person will talk to Fox News about this person mm-hmm. or MSNBC or whatever, okay? But nobody is talking with each other.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about each other or talking at each other.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk with each other.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And that's what I'm willing to do. And too many groups that call themselves anti-racist are bogus. And when I say that, I don't mean that in a bad way, but they're going about it the wrong way. Let's say the three of us or the four of us with our Jeff here, okay, we all have a group that fights against racism. And we meet the second Wednesday of every month. And all we do is get together and talk about how bad racism is
mm-hmm.
and somebody painted a swastika on the church in my neighborhood or whatever, okay? And that's all we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say, you know what? There are some skinheads or some neo-Nazis or some Klan people who live over there. You know, we know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Let's invite them to one of our meetings. Oh, no, we can't do that. We can't have mm-hmm. those people over here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
It makes them a hate group too.
Exactly. So how are you going to resolve anything if you don't talk to them? You may resolve nothing if you talk to them, sure. Okay. But at least you get to know who they are, understand where they're coming from, they understand where you're coming from. You're planting a seed.
Right.
And that's how you reach some kind of agreement or agree to not agree.
Disagree. Right.
Okay.
Right.
And that cuts down, that reduces the amount of racism. As a result of Roger Kelly leaving the Klan when he became my friend, okay? Today, there is no more organized Ku Klux Klan in the state of Maryland.
Mm.
There used to be a large contingency there, all right?
Oh, wow.
Now, that does not mean there are no more racists in Maryland.
Or yeah. no more members. You're not saying there are no members.
No, what I'm saying is there's no more organized. Ku Klux Klan.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you know, there are plenty of racists. You know, after the Klan falls apart, they run and join the police department or something, all right? But
right.
Every now and then, somebody will try to reestablish the Klan in Maryland,
mm-hmm.
and they'll try to have a rally up in Sharpsburg, and only four people will show up,
mm-hmm.
and two of them are drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's no more real organized Klan.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, sure, there's still some ex-members and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Okay, just for the sake of doing what we do, how does any of this relate to
relationships?
Well,
he dated a known Klanswoman.
Well, because we have to have relationships with the people who oppose us, who may have differing views.
Yes,
you know, because how are we going to learn about each other? By not doing that, we are fostering false beliefs
mm-hmm.
and festering racism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we need to establish those relationships.
And the similar skills that go into communicating when we have extreme differences,
mm-hmm.
I guess you could call them extreme differences, such as hate regarding race and that sort of thing, we can put those same skills into play with just romantic relationships.
Absolutely.
When we're dealing with issues that come up.
Absolutely.
Between. Yeah.
I mean, look, even with romantic relationships, if somebody has done, if your girlfriend or boyfriend or spouse has done something wrong to offend you or hurt you or whatever, you cannot move forward until you talk about it and there's an apology or forgiveness or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what makes a strong relationship, the ability to communicate with one another. You cannot have a loving relationship if there's no communication.
Right.
And, you know, we all are Americans. We all have to live in this country. And we all have to have a relationship with our fellow people. And hopefully it'll be one of love and respect.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we've been talking with the author of Clandestine Relationships, A Black Man's Odyssey in the Ku Klux Klan. He is Mr. Daryl Davis. Brother Davis, please tell us what you're up to and how we can find you.
Okay, well, the name of the book is called Clandestine Relationships, and clandestine spelled with a K, not a C. Clan-destine relationships. Right now, I took the book out of print last November, but it's being updated. It'll be back out again next year with all the stuff from the old book, from the original book, plus a lot of new stuff.
All right.
And people can find me at daryldavis.com. And Daryl is spelled D-A-R-Y-L, only one R. Daryldavis.com.
All right.
I wish you had brought the regalia.
I would have brought it. I had it in my car yesterday.
Nancy. Really?
Yeah.
Well, we but, could go, wow, so
well,
people would get a feel.
I got something I'll show you when we get off the air.
Okay.
Along today's journey, we've discussed interviewing a member of the Klan, actually leadership, communication, and ignorance. Thank you to my co-host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer, and thank you to my guest,
Mr.
Daryl Davis. You've been great. I hope you've had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble, as always.
Maybe next time I'll bring my date here.
Whoa. See? And we got, we got to talk more about the book,
too. This is radio, Frank.
Wow.
Let's do some show and tell, people. Oh, I love it.
As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr., that's M-R Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there. And if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.